This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Thank you very much. Glad to see you here on this beautiful afternoon in Chicago. Thank you for giving your time to be here. I have 10 minutes to explain to you the anti-ecological dynamics of global capitalism and to explain to you how we move forward. So I will speak fast. But a couple things more about myself. I wear many hats, so in addition to being a co-founder and a co-editor-in-chief with Lee of the journal Capitalism, Nature, and Socialism, I'm also on the board of Coming Clean, which is a coalition of about 300 different organizations ranging from Greenpeace to Environmental Justice Health Alliance. We help make strategy for the movement on the left behind the scenes and channel resources to grassroots organizations. Also a co-founder with the Global Center for Climate Justice. I serve as the research director. And also I'm the director of the Northeastern Environmental Justice Research Collaborative and worked with the leadership of the EJ movement in the United States for the last 30 years around a host of different issues. So the first thing, I would make a couple propositions. The first is that for those of us engaged in movement politics right now, the environmental movement is facing a tremendous paradox. And this paradox is, on the one hand, in the post-World War II period, the environmental movement has emerged as perhaps one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, social movement in the United States. Some 19 million Americans belong to environmental organizations. And you know, if you look at the so-called environmental decade, over 19 major statutes were passed. So at many important battles have been won over the preceding decades, but one could say that despite these victories, the movement is losing the war. The ecological crisis is continuing to deepen. We now see that climate change is beginning to feed upon itself and accelerate dramatically as these feedback mechanisms are kicking in. We have a chemicalization of our everyday environment where billions of pounds of toxic waste are released into the American environment, enough hazardous waste each and every day to fill Wrigley Field from top to bottom five times over. As a result, because of this chemicalization of our everyday environment, we have a cancer epidemic in this country. More children die of cancer now than any other time in U.S. history. More of this disease than any other disease for the first time in U.S. history. One out of every two men in this room, one out of every three women in this room will get cancer during their lifetime. So we can speak now of a crisis of environmentalism and a crisis of a liberal regime of environmental regulation because of its failure to attack corporate power has failed to halt a growing ecological crisis. And this crisis of the liberal regime of regulation has sponsored two political reactions. On the right, we see an effort by the most highly regulated sectors of American capital to embrace a new politics of neoliberalism, free market environmentalism, or in many cases, a direct assault on the environmental movement. So over the last 30 years, we've seen the formation of a very sophisticated network of think tanks and policy institutes, public relations firms, and so forth, that are devoted to convincing the American people that climate change is a hoax, that the environmental crisis is not real, and that we need to embrace free market principles to ensure prosperity for the American people. This is the most sophisticated propaganda campaign and most expensive propaganda campaign that's ever been sponsored in human history. Hundreds of billions of dollars committed to convincing us that the ecological crisis is not real. And behind this are the Koch brothers and the oil and gas industry, but other major corporate polluters, the railroad industry, the railroads, other industries that are tied deeply into the fossil fuel industry. We also have a critique that's being forged by the left. And for example, the environmental justice movement, which argues that, well, environmental policy unintentionally has served to displace ecological crises onto people who have less political economic power to resist. So while we can no longer dump toxic sewage sludge into the Atlantic Ocean if you live in New York City, if that toxic waste is now loaded up on 3,000 railroad cars each and every week and transported across country to Sierra Blanca, Texas, and disposed in a Latino community where 80%, like Sierra Blanca, where 80% of the population lives below the poverty line, the source of the crisis hasn't been arrested. It's just changed form and has been transported from one part of the country to another and impacting one group of people over another. So the main point I would like to illustrate here is from a neo-Marxist political economic perspective, or the employment of socialist political economic principles, we have this task, which is to explain what is it that leads capital, or American corporations, or global corporations in general, to knowingly inflict harm upon the American people, or the populations in their own country. And very simply put, from the perspective of capital, any investments that are made in pollution control technology do not contribute to increases in productivity, do not contribute to increases in profitability. They are considered to be what are called unproductive expenditures. And therefore, all things being given equal, or particularly if you're in a situation where it's a highly competitive marketplace, the imperative on behalf of capital is to, rather than absorb these costs, such as installing very expensive pollution control equipment in their operations, to displace this cost onto the general public or externalize these costs. They're called negative externalities. So that logic is driven by the profit imperative and the logic of economic efficiency. But how this is done is also determined not just by economic efficiency, but also political expediency. One of the most antisocial forms of behavior of American corporations is when they knowingly dump toxic waste in the community that are going to result in cancer and other types of health problems. No community is going to willingly accept such hazards, particularly if they know it's going to impact their health and that of their children. So capital adopts strategies which are not necessarily always the most economically efficient, but the most politically expedient. How can we dispose or externalize these social and ecological costs onto the general public in such a way that it minimizes political opposition, that offers the path of least resistance? So in the state of California, for example, the toxic waste industry in the state were having trouble getting communities to accept the building of incinerators throughout the state. And for good reason, because if you live near an incinerator, often if they're burning toxics, what you get out of the smokestacks are super toxics, like dioxins and mercuries and so forth. They're extremely dangerous to live near an incinerator, so communities were not accepting this. So they commissioned Sorrell Associates to do a report for the state of California and the chemical industry to help them figure out a solution to this problem. And on page 51 of the report, they conclude, under no such circumstances such a facility be built within a one-mile radius of a white middle-class community because of the greater likelihood of encountering political opposition. Instead, you should target rural communities, communities where the offending facility is on one line of political jurisdiction and the affected population is on another because it's harder to bring political action, working class communities, they footnote communities of color, Catholic communities because they're considered more conservative. Nowhere in the report does it talk about siting these facilities where they would minimize public health exposure to these dangerous chemicals. It's solely around the ability of a community to offer political opposition. After the report is issued, 17 incinerators are built in Southern California in the Los Angeles area. Every single one of them was located in a low-income community of color. 90% of the population in the impact zone were people of color around these 17 incinerators. And that's just one example of many and many. So the strategy increasingly over the last 30 years has been for capital to displace the ecological cost of production onto the least powerful communities, both within the United States, white working class communities, Latino communities, African American communities, indigenous communities, and also on communities that lack political economic power outside of the United States, increasingly displace harm onto countries that lack the political economic power to resist the imposition of these harms. Almost every country in the world has signed on to the Basel, Stockholm treaties, and many others, the Rotterdam Treaty, which prohibit the dumping of toxic waste, electronic waste, some of the most dangerous chemicals and so forth, onto the global south. Almost every country in the world has signed onto those except for the United States. So it's becoming increasingly a strategy to displace such harm both domestically and internationally. As you remember, Lawrence Summers, the lead economist under President Clinton and the Obama administration, one of the most important economic planners on behalf of American capital in the Democratic Party power structure, once stated as the chief economist of the World Bank that he always thought Africa was vastly underpolluted, that the United States should do what it can do to export more of these dirty factories and toxic waste to the people of Africa because it represents less cost to the global capitalist system. So at this particular moment, that is why we see the rise of an environmental justice movement in the United States that is devoted to increasingly challenging the displacement of ecological harm into working class communities and communities of color. The last thing I would say is, as a result of this, we can speak of issues of environmental racism and class-based environmental inequalities becoming of crisis proportions, not only in the United States, but around the world. The final point I would say is that, however, the goal of the environmental justice movement is not to ensure that all people are polluted equally. It's not a very good bumper sticker, and it's a hard slogan to galvanize people around. So the challenge that we face working in environmental justice circles, the challenge we face as ecological socialists is how can we invent a new type of politics, a more transformative environmental politics that goes to the root causes of the ecological crisis. It's not about distributing the harm more equitably per se. It's about preventing the harm from being produced in the first place. And the only way you can get there is through a socialist ecological politics. It requires a democratization of production. Last thing I'll say, in Europe, they're beginning to do this. In Europe, the burden is now placed on corporations to prove that a chemical is safe before it can be introduced into the marketplace. In the United States, the burden is placed upon the public to prove that a chemical is dangerous after it's been introduced into the marketplace, meaning we're all guinea pigs. So we can talk more about how we begin a multi-class, multi-racial, multinational movement which can unite people in a struggle around a more transformative environmental politics which addresses the root causes of the ecological crisis as grounded in the dynamics of capitalist accumulation and power. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Danny, for laying that groundwork for us. My name is Lee Brownhill. I am the co-editor-in-chief of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. I'm also a part-time academic in Canada, although I grew up here in Massachusetts in the United States. I want to just begin with a definition of feminism as the recognition that women are exploited under capitalism, both inside and especially outside of the waged workplace, and of course, the fight against that exploitation. Feminism is a fight against capitalist exploitation. And my socialist feminism also recognizes that women produce the most strategic commodity under capitalism, labor power. They produce it generationally, and they produce it on a daily basis. And some of these realities reflect in the politics, the divisive politics of today about banning abortion and banning and criminalizing gender nonconformity. How can you have a capitalist system reproducing labor of men and women if you can't tell who's a man or who's a woman? I mean, really. Eco-socialist ecofeminism extends this further to recognize that nature is equally exploited by capital. Capital is undermining the conditions of life on Earth. And like the fight back in feminism, that another world is not only possible, it's necessary, and that it's well on its way to being created through the concerted activism of generations of ordinary people from below. For me, my socialism is informed since the 1980s, when I was a student at UMass Amherst, by the work of the Trinidadian Pan-Africanist C.L.R. James. He emphasized the power of ordinary people to change the world. He urged socialists to study and understand resistance, not only to study and understand capital, but to understand resistance, to make it more effective in the fight against capital and in the fight for alternatives, to defend the commons and reinvent the commons. In his 1973 article, Call to the Seventh Pan-African Congress, James argued that there were three bases that he could see for an increase and making more effective the solidarity and organizational power of Pan-Africanism in his analysis, but I think it applies on a wider scale. Three bases for solidarity he spoke of: that solidarity and alliances should be continental, he's speaking of the continent of Africa, and global, not national. National too limited. International capital moves across borders. We can't stop at our borders. Secondly, that grassroots leadership, not elites, was the way to go. And thirdly, he quoted the Caribbean poet Derek Walcott, who said, "Women are a future that men must learn." 1973, 50 years ago, James was talking about grassroots women of the global South building global alliances. These perspectives have shaped my own activism and my scholarship for the last 30 years. I actually was invited and privileged to attend the 7th Pan-African Congress in Kampala, Uganda, in 1994, where the very issues that James discussed in 73 in that call to the 7th Pan-African Congress were very rigorously debated and moved forward, especially in the pre-conference women's meeting, where women in the Pan-African movement called on women and people of good faith all over the world to help and stand up with Africa against structural adjustment and the IMF. So one of the significant findings of my own scholarship and activism in studying resistance was to identify what I saw, and I'm not saying I was the only one to see this, but two opposing sets of social relations characterizing the class struggle. One which I would call the keystone social relation that holds up the patriarchal capitalist hierarchy of labor power. I call it, and colleagues of mine call it, the capitalist male deal. Now, don't be fooled. It doesn't only involve men. You can have female male dealers. You can have a woman owning Exxon and killing Africans with oil spills. You can have non-white, white nationalists. We have a multiracial neoliberalism, as much as we're fighting for a multiracial democracy, capital is fighting for its multiracial neoliberalism. So this Keystone capitalist, this Keystone relationship, the capitalist male deal, is another word for it, more commonly heard, is divide and rule, divide and conquer, or in the colonial period, indirect rule. Lord Lugard, in the 1920s, talking about how the British had to go in Africa or wherever they were in their colonial world, find either the leader who they could bribe, force into doing their bidding. Indirect rule. And I'm just going to read briefly because I did write a book about my studies of resistance in the Kenyan case over the long 20th century. And I, in particular, looked at cycles of struggle where capital, the colonialists, kept imposing different kinds of male deals to channel resources out of the country. So the history of colonial and corporate ascendancy in Kenya is marked by the cementing of specific successive male deals between selected African men on the one hand and colonial and post-colonial capitalists on the other. The British made male deals first with traders in the 1870s, then with the chiefs that they appointed in the 1920s, and finally with export cash crop farmers in the 1960s. Each new deal was introduced as a mechanism for restructuring their corporate activity and to deal with the fact that the people were resisting the imposition. Capital had to keep reforming itself. So as they amalgamated and restructured their production and trade from above, they simultaneously required the reorganization of labor from below. Let me just finish that quote by saying that the new male deals, as they took place, generated new types of resistance. And that is the social relations of alliance, solidarity, and unity and diversity of the struggles in the struggles against exploitation and violence of all kinds. If we go back to James's points about grassroots, third world or majority world, women and global alliances, we can see something that looks very much like the best of the social movements of today. And if we look at what those grassroots, global South activists and their allies, all up and down the hierarchy of labor power, all races, all genders, all ethnicities, joining together with the grassroots women, global South women. When we look at what those women are actually seeking and demanding, it's not only human life, human dignity, but also the cessation of the destruction of the earth. It's land back. It's land, food, freedom. Capital uses its enclosures and alienation to divide us from each other and from the earth. Our resistance, our socialism is the strongest when we draw together what's been torn asunder, unite people, defend the planet, seek to regain control over our own labor and its products. When you think of C.L.R. James, his most famous book, Black Jacobins, about the Haitian Revolution, in 1804, captive Africans freed themselves, freed, you know, they took back the private property of the slave owner, the private property of their own being, and inspired the abolition movement that, well, we still haven't quite won yet today. But this right wing, but this the power of this unity keeps capital on its toes. The backlash, the right-wing backlash we see today, is precisely the prickling, the realization by these male dealers, both the capitalists and those in the, I don't know what they call themselves, the 3%, reeling at the threats to their hegemony. They must seek division at all costs to keep capital going. And that should tell us something. We who are on the side of freedom, we who are on the side of solidarity, compassion, empathy, accountability, and transformation, that our solidarity with each other is not only good for us and good for our resistance, good for the building of alternatives, but it undermines the keystone social relation of capitalism. Without the male dealers, that 0.1% up there can't control the rest of us. So I want to bring that that concept to you and let you do with it what you will. I look forward to discussion.
I'm going to sit here. Can you all hear me okay? I talk with my hands a lot, so I need them both. Thank you all for the invitation to be here, and thank you to my co-panelists and chair. I am a popular educator, and I am a writer, and I also, what I'm writing right now is a book on Palestine, and some of the comments from Danny and from Lee and here, this whole conference, I think that they can be relevant. And one that I think about is, Danny, when you mentioned the paradox that the environmentalist movement is in, where there's so much more awareness than had ever been before, and a lot of people galvanized. But the paradox is that what the movement is struggling for is actually getting worse. The situation is getting worse. And that's something that I see in Palestine quite a bit, in that the more awareness that has come about the Palestinian struggle over the last generation following the peace accords, the worse the situation has gotten on the ground. And so much of that Palestinian struggle, like the environmentalist movement, that story travels through institutions that are not very kind, let's just put it that way, to the planet, whether they are the international courts or the universities, right, or the corporate media. And I think that that could be something that we rethink, like, where are our narratives going? Where is our struggle traveling through? Because when we need to tell our story, when we want to tell our story in those institutions, we need to make our stories make sense to them. And a lot of the time, it defangs our struggles. And I want to focus on this question of capitalism, specifically with the question of nature and the environment. In the popular education work that I do at home in Oxnard, California, a lot of it has been about reading books out loud in parks or in living rooms or in gardens or bicycle shops, so that we can understand them. The out loud reading part is for comprehension, because there's so much trauma with education, with learning, with books. And so we try not to replicate school. And what we've done is we've read several books, and one of them was large sections of Capital Volume 1 out loud, stopping after each paragraph to say, hey, what do you think this means? It's a very difficult book if you've attempted it. And what we came out of that, particularly on in the first part of Capital Volume 1, the section on the commodity, we could see, even though Marx didn't say, we can add and we build this question of the ravaging of the earth. When we study capital and the ways that it functions with the labor theory of value, or the value theory of labor, however we describe it, where it is labor that produces value and that gets extracted from the boss, the capitalist. That's the surplus value extraction. We don't talk a lot about where so much other value came from. And so much work that happens in the world produces that value that goes unsaid and unquantified as such under capital, and a lot of that is through the earth. So when we think of, for example, this piece of paper came from a tree. I hope the workers, whoever made the paper itself, were compensated well for their time. But did anybody ask the tree what kind of compensation they would like in order to be cut down to be made into paper? Did anybody consider to ask the tree if the tree was willing to be part of this relationship the way that the wage worker gets asked? It's a consensual relation. This is a distinction between the wage worker and the enslaved, and also the wage worker and the unwage worker. If there is work that is done under capital, so much of our fights have been revolving around the waged worker. And as Lee's presentation pointed out, there is so much more that happens beyond the wage. Under capitalism, what is important is the extraction of profit. We might call that the extraction of others' energy or other power to be congealed for future use in terms of money. But what we don't talk about is where the rest of the work comes from. Bees do a lot of work, and under capital, they're not valued as such. They're not compensated. They're not asked if it's okay for us to eat their honey. They're not asked if they want to be part of the pollination of the plants so that we could eat. So this is a huge distinction that we've pulled out that's really necessary for us to think about when we think about capitalism, nature, socialism. It's important to not discount the nature part. You know, if you make paper and I make pencils, for example, we can exchange paper and pencils according to the amount of time that it took for us to make that. But again, who's asking the tree? And how would we even compensate the tree? Because what is a tree? What even makes a tree? Do we compensate the soil microbes? Do we compensate the air, the wind for pollinating? Do we compensate water? Like, that's impossible to do. Impossible to do under capitalism. And so what happens under capitalism is that there is a massive devalorization of the world. And it's understood that only humans create value, but asterisk on that, because it's only specific humans. It is not enslaved humans. It is not those that are closer to nature. It is not the unwaged housewife traditionally, or house partner traditionally, right, who reproduces you so that you can go to work, because the boss is always talking mess to you and hurting you, harming you in so many ways. You come back to work, and then there's your partner to rejuvenate you so that you can go back to work. So all of these things are externalized out to others. And so we need to be careful when we talk about capital, nature, socialism, that we're not just talking about capitalism and socialism, right? We are part of nature. We are nature. There has been, even before capitalism, a really big problem in a lot of European philosophy that separates the human from the non-human in a hierarchical way, where the human is superior to the non-human, and the non-human is there to be exploited and used as a resource for the human. That existed way before capitalism. I mean, that's also the governing logic of patriarchy, which has existed way before capitalism, of the male on top and non-male below. And this whole relationship of competition, what capitalism does is it makes that real to our everyday lives. It expands it into our ways of being. It makes it math. It makes it scientific. It makes it so naturalized that we don't understand, or we're taught not to understand any other way. Thank you. I was checking for that. So I will just wrap up. I have 2 minutes. And these are just introductory remarks so that we can talk about these questions together. So that's why we're keeping it pretty short. I will put out there a metaphor that might be useful, And the metaphor in our organizing work is one offered by the Zapatistas recently in Chiapas, the metaphor of the capitalist hydra. They say that capitalism is a beast that grows many different heads. When we fight off one, another one sprouts. And usually that's the new one that sprouts is one of our own desires. It can even look like us. It can resemble us. It's there to disarm us, to neutralize us. Now, the hydra doesn't have to be that a domineering kind of metaphor. Under capitalism, that's exactly what it is. The hydra metaphor has been used in the Haitian Revolution in a really helpful way. Shout out to William C. Anderson, who pointed this out to me. Maroon Choate's writings, The Dragon and the Hydra, talks about in the Haitian Revolution, the dragon being the more armed military force and the hydra being the everyday people's creation of the world, and how the dragon kind of ended up taking over the revolution. But in the hydra in that case was of the below, of the people. The hydra of capitalism is that beast of the above that extracts from the below, or crushes the below. It only exists like the master. It only exists because there's a slave. Once we flee, once we maroon out, once we exit the situation, if the master wants to remain the master is going to come and get us. So we got to be prepared. The way to do this in the most nonviolent way is for everyone to stop wanting to be somebody's master. I'll leave it at that.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.